You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello, welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. With me in the studio, Allison McCann, visual journalist. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
And Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
What's up, Chad?
Guys, how do you feel to be back in the studio after last week's panic room? What do we call that?
The coat room.
The coat check, yeah. The memorial, the vigil to Kate Fagan is doing well in the corner. Kate, we miss you. The candles are burning brightly. And guys, there's some news from the Hot Takedown award space. It's a very crowded space. Many awards on our mantle, but this week, this month, we were named one of the 10 best sports podcasts in all of the internet. Is that where podcasts live? The internet, right?
Sure.
Congrats to both of you. Thanks to Awful Announcing for naming us.
Now, are you sure that the list from Awful Announcing wasn't saying that we were one of the 10 most awful?
You know, the Slate people made the same question, and it's a good point. I was listening to their own announcement of their own award, and I'm not sure. Awful Announcing is dedicated to both showing the awfulness of announcing and the best of people who critique that announcing, perhaps. And we are nothing if not announcement critiquers. On today's show, first, last year we spent half the spring talking about how good UConn's women's basketball team was and whether anything could stop them. We'll check in on this year's team and whether Breonna Stewart is going to get her fourth consecutive NCAA championship. And then Kate Fagan's going to be mad with us, but we could not wait any longer. We're going to talk Porzingis, the Kristaps variety. Nate Silver will swing by to tell us whether he is the next Dirk or the next Sabonis, or if he breaks the mold of NBA players entirely. And finally, college football coach salaries are increasingly being based on their players' academic success, and one can't measure academic success without deploying all-encompassing metrics. We'll talk with Deadspin writer Nick Martin about how coaches are making hundreds of thousands of dollars, extra dollars, as long as their players pass their classes. The UConn Huskies are 8-0 this season, winners of three straight NCAA titles, and still the giants of NCAA women's basketball. Before the Warriors, there were the Huskies. Here's Debbie Antonelli from the podcast Dishin' and Swishin', great name for a podcast, explaining why she thinks South Florida will beat Connecticut once this year and finally end the Huskies' winning streak.
They lost to Connecticut last year three times because they had to play them three times. And in the three times that they played them, they lost by 42 the first time, 23 points the second time, 14 points the third time. Then I'm going way out on a limb, and because they're going to get to probably play them three times, I think at some point this year that they are going to have a game that they are going to win over Connecticut.
Because they got closer and closer to winning at some point last year, and because they have three shots of winning this year, they will beat them. Does that hold logic? And do the metrics suggest she's right, that UConn is that vulnerable?
No, not really. So
I think she did a nice, like, I'm going out on a huge limb.
Yes,
so
certainly.
Hopefully she understands the sort of absurdity in her own deduction of, I don't know, it was almost like halving the scores. So she was just like, therefore, they will win.
Yeah, she couched it somewhat appropriately, I guess. And maybe, like, if they continue at that rate of progress of, even if they have it each time, they won't ever actually surpass UConn. The best they can do is just sort of incrementally get closer. But just looking at the numbers so far this season, UConn, they're 8-0. They have the best rating, according to Jeff Sagarin, who is a guy that does the USA Today power ratings and does them for all kinds of different sports and endeavors. He has them rated as number one, and they've been number one for a long time. if we just take like a mix of their performance so far this season and their performance last season, a little like what we do with ELO ratings, which is our favorite metric of choice, you would see that UConn is favored to beat South Florida, not by a small margin, but by 26 points, which actually sort of lines up with what she was saying from last year, that if you took the average of all of those games, that UConn would beat South Florida on average by 26 points. And if we think that last year it doesn't matter, you can look at the results so far this season, eight games in. UConn is favored according to the power ratings by a similar amount. Or you can say that looking at last year's rating is a pretty good proxy for how teams will do this year, in especially in women's college basketball, because there is so little shakeup. There's not a lot of opportunity for teams that were sort of good but not great, like South Florida, to move up, or for teams like UConn to completely fall apart, because things are so stratified, and we've talked about that in the past.
Yeah, and let's not knock South Florida. Losing to UConn by 26 points is not bad, considering that last year UConn averaged, I think, beating teams by, I think it was in the 40s, and at halftime they were usually up by 25 points. I think Ben Morris, one of our writers, read a nice piece that said, yeah, at the average UConn game last year, the Huskies were winning by 25 points. And so South Florida is still a very great team, but, we're eight games into the season here. I guess for UConn, they're 8-0. South Florida is already 6-2. So at the onset of this season, things are looking very good for you, continuing on their 45 straight game win streak here, and not so well for South Florida.
Yeah, according to the power rating that I kind of concocted between this season and the preseason expectations, all but 15 teams in the entire country would be UConn would be favored by 25 or more points against. So again, there's like not really much shame in that, but that also implies that the odds of them even winning once are pretty low, even if they get three cracks at them.
Which team is closest? Is it Notre Dame?
So Notre Dame, yeah, is second, and this is also sort of speaks to UConn's absurd advantages that they have over teams, is that they would be favored to beat Notre Dame by 14 points, according to the metrics, and no team is closer than 14 points to them right now as we speak.
And well, they were only 10 when they played, I guess, whatever that was, 2 weeks ago, UConn and Notre Dame. But, we're, again, at the very early onset of the season, so I feel like talking about UConn last season is probably our best way of understanding UConn this season at this early on.
Especially in women's college basketball, where there's less turnover year to year than there is that we see in other men's sports. And you see that with Breonna Stewart, who has three championships in her first 3 years.
Three for three.
Playing at UConn, and is now, as we've been saying, well-positioned for a fourth. I've been trying to get my head around that, of like how rare that would be. And I don't know if you have any numbers around that, Neil, sort of how much luck is involved with a team this good to actually win a championship. But just to find a window in order to be on a team that could be that good, it has some luck involved.
Yeah, I don't know what her process of picking colleges was like when she was thinking about which program to join. And I would assume that UConn was pretty high on the list the whole time for her, if not number one. And the odds of winning four straight anything, like we saw, this has come up again and again, like Kentucky needing to win six straight games to win the national championship on the men's side, or a lot of these other things. The Patriots going undefeated at one point. Now the Panthers are looking at it. It's tough to string together a lot of things. So this is really rare and really impressive. But then one of the other things, I again was digging around with some of the power rating numbers, and I found that the four Stewart teams, if we sort of project out this year's team to what it might look like by the end of the season, they're four of the five best teams in all of women's college basketball over the last five seasons. And also numbers one through three are the 2015 team is number one, the 2014 team is number two, and then this year's team looks like it's number three. So she's been on the best teams in college basketball over the past 5 years.
Was that 15 that wasn't one of her teams? Was it also UConn?
They were all UConn teams. Yeah, the only interloper was Baylor from 2012.
That's my question. Was Baylor one of the top five?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they were number four.
Got it.
because we're only looking at the past 5 years of women's college basketball, not all women's college basketball.
And that speaks a little to the data availability frustrations that you've talked about too, Allison.
Yeah, because I guess I would
sports.
Go on the if we did have all years, I'm sure I think it was like 01-02 UConn women that had Swin Cash and Sue Bird and would probably be up there in that top five, Stuart. But based on what we do have, I think it is remarkable to see that her three seasons are up there in three, and her fourth is likely to be in the top five.
So you mentioned, Neil, that you know it's really hard to go undefeated, as we talked about regularly on the show. Is it harder to win four championships than it is to go undefeated in one season? Because in order to win four championships, you have to win, what is it, six games in the tournament in four consecutive years. That's 24. That's a string of 24 undefeated, if you will, right? Just in postseason play against the best teams. So already there's sort of like a, what is that, three quarters of a season packed in there. So I'm trying to make sense of what I should be more impressed by. Just off the back, you know, back top of your head, back of the napkin, what do you guys think? Is it harder? Because you can lose along the way, obviously, in the regular season.
But you can't lose in the tournament.
You can't lose in the tournament. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's until you said that, it really makes an impact to think about how many straight tournament games you have to win four straight championships in college basketball. I don't really know off the top of my head. I would guess that it's harder to go undefeated just because there are more games in total. That, like, you're going to have to play. Kentucky had to play near about 40 games and would have had to go undefeated through all of those rather than just the 24. But if you think about it, those 40 are, you know, maybe half of them are against teams that are not really that good. A handful of them are against teams that are really not that good. So I guess I'll change my opinion. I'll flip-flop on myself and say that it's probably harder to win those tournament games.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think,
what do you think, Allison?
I think I would agree with your second, that especially because given how stratified women's college basketball is, I don't think UConn is facing good teams in the regular season as much. They don't get those really, really close games until, you know, they have an average of, they're up by 25 points at halftime in most of their regular season games last year. So I would say that for them, for women's college basketball, I do think it is more impressive to me to see hopefully for consecutive national championships.
Excellent. Let's move on. That is the Latvian rap anthem of Kristaps Porzingis.
Is that his intro? His at-bat music? Like he's the Cespedes of the NBA?
I think the Knicks should certainly play it if they aren't playing it in Madison Square Garden. That voice you hear, listeners, is Nate Silver, editor-in-chief of 538. Guys, can you guess the translation of that track that we just heard? I have the translation.
Isn't it just his name?
There was other Latvian
there are other words.
On. If you're looking at him, you're looking up Kristaps Porzingis. Who is the one with more money? Kristaps Porzingis.
This is like Google Translate? There's got to be cooler than that. Like, if you're making it rain, who are you? Right?
This is whatever Joe, producer Joe, gave to me before the show. I'm not sure what his proficiency
Joe, is this
Latvian.
Real Latvian.
I would assume that Joe used some type of translation service.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
So what else is there to say besides who is the one with more money? And if you're looking at him, you're looking up about Kristaps Porzingis, 7'3" Latvian teenager, guy scoring 18 points per 36 minutes, 11 rebounds per 36, and already has more three-pointers than all but three other super tall guys in NBA history. Yes, he was the fourth pick in the draft, but nobody expected him to be this good this quickly. This week, Nate and Kirk Goldsberry have been diving deep into Porzingis' first couple months in the league, and Nate is here to tell us what he's found. But first, Nate, before we get there, let's listen to our Porzingis take. The rap anthem did not count. Here's Dirk Nowitzki giving his take on whether comparisons between himself and Porzingis are fair.
It's more than fair. You know, he's probably way ahead of the curve. When I was 20, I was scared to death out there, you know, competing against some of my heroes, and I had a brutal first year. I mean, he's almost averaging a double-double, so he's way better than I was at 20, so the comparison is probably unfair to him.
So inherent in there is that, I think because they're both tall, white, European guys, that like they're supposed to be comparables. Nate, you used our famous Carmelo system, which looks at which players are like other players in NBA history. Was Dirk even close to the top?
So Dirk is actually right about Dirk, where Dirk, I think, is somewhere around 20 or 25 on the list. But he's that low because Dirk was not very good as a 20-year-old rookie, and Porzingis has been quite good. So it thinks that comparison is unflattering to Porzingis, therefore he's fairly low on the list. But it is true that like when we should do like a whole episode about this, but when we tend to typologize guys, there's some ethnic and racial coding, right? I think his top two comps are Brook Lopez and Joe Smith.
Smith.
And then like Kevin Love. I mean, it's a weird list. Anthony Davis.
Does that
is
mean
like
he's
five
breaking
six.
Carmelo?
Sort of, yeah.
Amare.
I mean, it's based on comparable players based on historical precedence. If you're a 7'3" tall Latvian, never mind the Latvian part, right? But there's never been a player in NBA history who was this tall, this young, and who could shoot the three, right? You've never had that three-way overlap on the Venn diagram exactly. So you can see Carmelo make all sorts of weird compromises, right? Like if you look on his long list, you have Shaquille O'Neal there, and you have Darko. You know, you've Kevin
Racial
Love.
Bias in Carmelo too.
I mean, I don't know, but like, I mean, we could actually test that at some point and see whether similar players or similar racial backgrounds are more likely to come up or not. But you know, you have Yi Jianlan. Am I saying that right, Neil?
Chairman Yi Jianlan. Yeah, Chairman Yi.
Wait, did you just correct Nate's pronunciation of a Chinese
like
surname? Really?
It's like John Huntsman. No one's gonna get that reference.
Hey, he's also one of the most notorious sort of bad ways that a player of that typology could work out. Because on paper, he seems like he could be kind of similar to Porzingis, right? Like big guy, you know, shoots the three. But Porzingis is just like miles better at the same age.
And you have Amari Stoudemire. It's weird. I mean, it kind of sees him developing into an offensive threat. Not that he's a negative on offense now. He's probably a league average offensive player. But it figures that, hey, here's a guy who's got all types of range all over the court. You know, not a deadly accurate shooter right now. But, you know, gets a lot of pretty good looks. His free throw shooting is not bad. That's usually a positive sign. You know, and the most fundamental thing is that even though he might be kind of a weird, freaky player, I mean that as a compliment, if you are at league average as an NBA player at age 20, as a rookie, the NBA is as tough as there is of any sport on rookies. You don't have a minor league system, really. You go from playing in Porzingis, I think he played like 50, 60 games last year in Europe, but usually you go from playing 30 games as a collegian to 82 games now all of a sudden. So if as a 20-year-old rookie, you're kind of even in the rotation, you have a pretty bright future. And if you're average or above, then you have superstar potential.
Yeah, and I think just for our listeners, we should make clear that when we are saying Carmelo, in case it wasn't clear the first time, this is not Carmelo Anthony, his teammate, but Carmelo the modeling, the model, and I know sometimes we personify our models, but I want to make that clear. So we know who he's sort of like, which is nobody. What was the career projection? You mentioned that it was more offensive. I mean, are we looking at the franchise player that Knicks fans seem to desperately want him to be?
Maybe. So the baseline case is a 7-win player or so on average every year, and a 7-win player is a guy who borderline all-star. That's a pretty good player. It's a pretty good baseline projection. There are some scenarios where he's getting up to 13, 14, 15 wins, which is a borderline MVP candidate instead. So the upside is there. The downside is probably injury risk, where there has never been, I call them super giants, NBA players who are 7'3" or above. There's never been a super giant who played in 1,000 NBA
That's
games.
Incredible.
Mark Eaton, I think, is the closest. And you see kind of a conspicuous drop-off in the number of players above 7 feet, and there are all types of interesting reasons why this might be the case. Could be that guys no longer exaggerate their height once they're above 7'0", but it could also be that, you know, you put a lot of strain on your lower body. We all remember Yao Ming, we remember Sean Bradley, all their kind of constant injury problems. So as well-rounded as he is, the concern's more that you have some attrition risk, whether it's actually he doesn't play because he's hurt or decline in play. I mean, Phil Jackson kind of said, this guy might be too tall. That, you know, if he were 7'1 instead of 7'3, then it might not prevent him from doing anything he can do on the court right now. But maybe there's a little bit less of an injury risk.
Well, one thing that I think is pretty exciting about him, though, is that, like, even at this young age, he shows up really good defensively in the metrics.
For sure, yeah.
Which sort of suggests that even if he becomes sort of, like, you know, if his progress stalls at some point on offense, that he could be a useful player if he's at age 20 going to be, you know, a good, just outright good defender according to the metrics. There's a long history of the NBA having guys that are seven-footers that just, you know, clog up the lane and still provide some value. And
yeah,
that's
Mark
kind of
Eaton
the worst
scored
case.
Mark
Eaton,
4.5 points a game.
Yeah,
no, so it's true,
of,
and that's where the height does have a pretty linear relationship. And but you know, it's the advanced stats that say he's pretty good, but also the eye test and also the fact that the Knicks are not allowing a lot of field goals around the rim this year, and it's been a huge problem for the franchise. Well, I guess since Tyson Chandler departed, but you see it reflected in the team stats too, and it's not much of a mystery who's made that difference this year.
At the end of your piece, Nate, that's coming out later this week, you talk about one looming issue for Porzingis could kind of be durability and longevity. Yeah. Why could that be the case?
Well, for one thing, he has a fair amount of attrition in his comparables, guys who just weren't playing regularly 3 or 4 years in, despite being quality players. For another thing, the taller you get on his list, the more injury-prone players were. So we actually couldn't find, like I said earlier, very many 7'3" guys just because there are very few 7'3" or above guys, period. Very few of them were playing the league. I think only two before were playing the league at age 20. So that's a concern. We don't have a big empirical sample of how guys who are that tall age and whether there really is a difference between being 7'1" or 7'2" and then taller. Of course, Kareem, most durable player in NBA history, was 7'2". So to say it's impossible when you add that extra inch, probably not true, but still, I think that's where some of it comes in. And very often when you see a Carmelo 7-year forecast, you'll see a guy make big improvement in year 1, year 2, a little bit improvement in year 3, and then level off in his wins above replacement projection. That doesn't mean he'll stop developing as a player. It means that if he's healthy, he'll probably still have some growth. But you get in the cases where a guy is hurt, and that's a 10% risk and a 20% risk as you go forward, and that actually subtracts quite a bit of value if you're being actuarial.
Yeah, so before this season, Carmelo, the model, didn't forecast Porzingis at all because we had European numbers instead of collegiate numbers, so we weren't able to do what we do with other NBA rookies. And even after, what has it been, 20-something games, I think? 25 games. What I'm hearing you say, Nate, is we still don't know. Like that there is something about NBA rookies where, you know, we remember the LeBrons and the Kobes who come in and just look like they're going to be superstars from the get-go. But there's so much wiggle room of awful things happening with injury. Or
yeah, and it does sense. I mean, I've never seen we have 90% confidence in a band. I've never seen bands as wide as you have on Porzingis, so it kind of knows what it doesn't know. I would think, I mean, Neil, Allison, what do you think? If they did a redraft today, he would be number 2 pick or the number 1?
Behind Towns.
Yeah, I mean, Towns has played so well that it's kind of a toss-up, but the fact that it even is a toss-up seems crazy. Like, it would have seemed so crazy, especially given the backlash to the pick and toward
Phil Jackson. He definitely wouldn't have been booed like he was.
And Stephen A. Smith definitely would not have issued his infamous rant against the pick.
It is interesting, right? Because people were going on no information about Porzingis, really, right? And for better or worse, Carmelo, and we only ran these numbers after the draft, so it's a little bit cheating. But it did think the top three were the top three. We could probably do another segment about Okafor at some point, and whether his career might turn out to be a mess or not. But there were three standout picks. The Knicks had number 4, and they kind of swung for the high upside case. You know, one thing is, having a 7'3" guy, you at least are going to get a good defensive player in all probabilities. So you're not drawing a complete zero, and then maybe you have lots of upside apparently on top of that. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying as a kind of slightly half-assed Knick fan, I'm not saying I was like really excited by it. I was hoping that Okafor could slip and then he could have all the problems he's having in Philly and New York instead. But I'm not sure why that selection was resoundingly panned and booed.
Well, I think it goes back to sort of like we talked about racially coded stuff before. I think people look at you
who was
Mayek
Lampe or who the hell is
Maysege Lampe or whatever. Yeah. I mean, there was the guy that Vince Carter jumped over that was a Knicks draft pick, Frederick Weiss, I think was his name. There's been a long history, basically like since Dirk, of a lot of these prospects out of Europe, not panning
Bargnani.
Out. Andrea Bargnani, that sort of fit the same description. I think we talked about Dirk also being this like constant point of comparison for Porzingis, is that the people beat the bushes trying to find the next Dirk, and maybe they even had that like exact typology in their head where like this is the only type of European player that we're looking for, because he was a player that came out of, you know, obscurity also, and like you said, he didn't have a very good rookie season even, but then every successive player, who was around 7 feet and from Eastern Europe got compared to Dirk just continuously. And I don't know if this breaks the cycle permanently or even if there was a cycle, because there weren't really that many picks. You could probably have, you know, flops happen just due to chance. And then we think that there's a pattern of, oh, these guys can't cut it in the NBA. But I definitely think it was, you know, that racial coding.
I mean,
it's not
like any of these guys. I mean, Towns did not have huge stats in college. I thought he was actually kind of quite a graceful and elegant player. But still, it's not like these guys have a resume chock full of incredible accomplishments based on, you know, being 1 year in the rotation at Kentucky and scoring, what do you score, 11 points a game or something. It's not like he's bowling people over.
Right, but yeah. Nobody these days really seems to put up like a slam dunk type of resume coming out of school, even with the one and done, maybe because of the one and done.
Well, we're seeing with Simmons at LSU, Ben Simmons at LSU, that might be different this year.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, again, we're so short, so early into the season, but let's see.
Can I ask about what Porzingis is not good at? When I glance at his Carmelo card, he's, you know, his five key stats are all above the 50th percentile besides his assist rate. So what's going on there?
I mean, most big gawky guys are not tremendous passers. Maybe that can develop over time if you have a high basketball IQ, quote unquote. A more subtle thing is he's not really able yet to create his own shots. And that's not coming from me. That's coming from Kirk looking at the shot chart. A very high percentage of his shots are assisted, which can work fine in a modern ball movement NBA offense.
Might not be the Knicks offense.
Maybe not the Knicks, right? But no, I mean, but you know, he's doing okay. I mean, the Knicks don't have a huge amount of high usage players except for Carmelo, and so he kind of works pretty well as a second banana. If he were kind of on like a Timberwolves team where they have Rubio. Apart from Rubio, the team cohesion is not really all that good. Then, you know, but I think he's, I don't know. I was going to say, oh, he's in a great situation. Of course, it's the Knicks. And it's like, no, maybe it doesn't totally make sense. But you know, he's set up well in the sense that they need some high usage players, but they have Carmelo to take some of the harder ISO looks. And so that's a nice developmental situation for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like if you're perhaps a potential phenom, you want to break in with a team that maybe doesn't have its offense set, so they can build around it a bit.
We've been thinking a little bit about like kind of Carmelo for next year, and like so Okafor, by the advanced stats, is incredibly terrible, right? Like just beyond awful, like worse than Kobe Bryant. you know. Is that because the Sixers are not really caring about whether he succeeds or not? Is that because they're tanking a little bit? And how does that affect our ability to project him? If you took him out of that environment and put him in some league average club, Denver or some team that kind of develops bigs okay, then then how much difference would that make? It's a thing we're going to look at probably for next year.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, so I did some research last year just over the NBA in general as to, like, does the amount of talent that you're playing alongside, what kind of impact does that have on your numbers? And it looks like it's not that much of an impact for all of the NBA, but it's still an open question, like you said, for a player, you know, going through their developmental phase. You know, it just anecdotally, it can't be great to play in the death pit that is the Sixers.
Yeah, and I think, you know, another thing that we're realizing more and more is that guys who are like Carmelo create their own shots, even if they're not great shots. Maybe they have kind of like a flatter confidence interval, right? Where, you know, you put them in New York versus putting them in Miami or something, or, I mean, not Miami anymore, right? But Golden State, maybe you don't have that much of a difference, whereas a guy who's more dependent on his teammates can make a big swing.
Oh, I think that's totally true. And we've seen in the past, like, players who have high usages can sort of take it down a little, and maybe their efficiency doesn't change that much. But then, you know, low usage players, you ask them to kick it up, you know, several notches, and sometimes they fall apart. You can't really predict what will happen to their efficiency.
I'm breaking in here to force you guys to stop.
Basketball nerd time.
A lot this of basketball. Really,
whew, listeners, you can read Nate and Kirk's piece on Porzingis coming soon at 5:38. Nate, thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thank you.
What should a college football coach get paid for? To shape the lives of young men a la Friday Night Lights, to just win the damn games, or to make sure his athletes graduate just in case they're part of the vast majority of college football players who don't make it to the NFL? Those questions are at the heart of a recent Deadspin article by Nick Martin called "College Football Coaches Are Making Millions Off a Useless Metric." The article explores the strange corners of coaching contracts in college football and how academic metrics have become tied to the coaches' bonus pay. Here to talk with us is journalist Nick Martin. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Okay, so Nick, lay out the basics here. There are a few acronyms that are all over your piece. There's FGR, APR, GSR. These are all about whether athletes pass their classes and graduate. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So when you, the biggest part that you know, I kind of touch on is the academic progress rate. And that's this. It's roughly 12 years old, implemented by the NCAA, and it gives you a point for every 2 points for every student, one for eligibility and one for retention. And a lot of it's been tied by the NCAA to academic success. And so the article just wanted to see how that measured up against GSR and FGR, which are, you know, graduation success rate and then federal graduation rate, which measure you up against the national averages, opposed to just, you know, ability to stay eligible and retain.
Right. So one of the interesting things in your piece is whether or not the NCAA has created this situation in which coaches are exploiting these, I would argue exploiting, but some might not, but are using these academic graduation rates and things like that to get paid more. And because the NCAA values these metrics, this quantified way of looking at academic success, that the coaches are able to then make more money because the universities want and need the coaches to deliver a program that meets these marks.
Yeah, absolutely. I go back and I'm looking at, you know, and you, I think obviously I'm on your side of the argument talking about when you're looking at the incentivization. But what we kind of found when we were going through the bonuses, or not just bonuses, but the contracts. So this is all part of the giant project we're working on with Daniel Kalish of HKM, which is a law firm out in Los Angeles, and Tommy Craig, the former executive editor of Gawker. You know, those are the guys I'm kind of my point people. And so when we're going through the coach contracts, we're just looking for things that kind of struck us as maybe unusual, or whether in a mass form or in an individual contract. And what we saw in the APR was that coaches were kind of getting paid hundreds of thousands of money. Obviously, as the first example, Dave Doran of NC State, which is actually, you know, my favorite team growing up. You know, he can make $700,000 just to make sure basically that his athletes go to class, and he's not even the one, particularly, you know, on a day-to-day basis, making sure that that happens. So that's why we decided to take a bit of a closer look. And, you know, what we found was that, and after talking to the guys we talked to, which are Dr. Mark Nagel and Richard Southall of South Carolina. You know, what we found was that APR really doesn't kind of hold up in terms of being the strict measure that the NCAA sells it or, you know, advertises it as. And so that's kind of where we were taking it from the article.
So is this an example of something where, like, the academic success metrics just aren't measuring, like, how well the student-athletes are progressing toward a degree or how much they're actually learning? Is that one of the chief complaints about it, is that they're not measuring what we think they're measuring?
Yeah, that's mainly it. I mean, it's mostly, you know, I don't want to be too, you know, I guess one side or the other on this, but what it's kind of been rolled out as is this more of a rebranding of how the NCAA displays its academic, you know, various academic rates, and it's come up with the APR, which has kind of allowed, you know, and a lot of it was, you know, we asked the question, why 930? Why do you use the score 930? And it's just a visual thing. It's specifically so you can look at it and say 930 out of 1,000 seems pretty great. But in reality, that only comes out to, and this is something that I can't remember if the Southall and Nagel brought up, but it only comes out to about a 50% graduation rate. And so, you know, it's just the idea that when the NCAA can put out press releases that are most of the times kind of just republished by a lot of the media to say that, okay, well, you know, APRs are at an all-time high, people just kind of take it at face value of what is being presented to them. And so this was more of a, you know, what we found was that it does not measure it in the way that we're initially, or most of us initially believe it does.
Yeah, when I was reading about how the NCAA sort of came up with APR on their site, I feel like this is absolutely one of those, like, social experiments in the way, like, people understand, like, numbers, because it was like, so you get 1 point for staying in school and 1 point for being academically eligible, and then they're like, and then we multiply it by 1,000, you know? Like, we could have just had a base system, or exactly, we could have just had a 50% graduation rate, but, like, they were like, people hearing 50% of your team is graduating is, like, not impressive, but hearing, like, 979, yeah, you're like, with no context, is a completely useless
metric. What was super interesting to me was that there are several different metrics that the coaches are being paid through or based on, and they're redundant with one another. That, like, a graduation rate and this and the APR, that the similar things are baked into it. Whether a player is eligible to play is going to feed into whether or not he's eligible to graduate and eventually does graduate, right? And so, like, these incentive structures are broken out so that if you have the bare minimum, you're going to get paid. And if you if your players do really well academically, you're going to get paid five times over. Why not just have one thing that pays out? I didn't quite understand why, aside from agents being involved and there being a competitive marketplace, why there's so many layers of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we found was that it doesn't make sense from, you know, anybody's perspective except the coaches on why he would get paid all this money. And even then, it just seems, what we kind of found was that it was just the work of, you know, agents kind of, and you look at it across the board, you know, we have all the public university head coaching contracts, and the majority of them have this, like, have some sort of academic incentive in them. And when you look at that and you kind of look at what they're being based off of, and, you know, there are certain things that maybe, you know, like you said, whether it's graduation rate, like, there are certain things that, you know, maybe they should get, you know, maybe you should be rewarded for it. But to be consistently and redundantly rewarded, you know, to the same measures, just kind of repackaged and, you know, given a different scale and maybe a different name, that part didn't make as much sense to us.
And the other thing that I thought was really interesting and sad was that the big colleges that already pay their coaches absurd amounts of money seem to be also the colleges that have the apparatuses in place to make the coaches get these bonuses, whereas some of the poorer colleges are the ones that actually kind of failed this APR standard. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can just look at, like, when you're looking at the article, it's like, we didn't cherry pick, you know, I didn't go through and say, okay, well, these are the big names, so these are who I'm going to focus on. Like, I picked, you know, like I said, I picked all the ones with contracts over 100,000, I think. And even then, like, you still, wasn't all of, I couldn't fit it all in the article because they would just start to get redundant and you'd get bored. But, you know, what it, you know, it's all Power Five. You know, it doesn't make sense to have this one size fits all program in place when you've got schools that are vastly different, you know, in terms of what they're able to do for their athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was, I think, one of the most interesting things for me in your piece is that, you know, sort of this criticism of APR is that it, you know, sort of disadvantages smaller schools and historically Black colleges and universities who don't have these massive academic resource centers that are directing student athletes to, oh, it's your season, take this easy class, you know, like all of these things that absolutely bolster GPAs and can help student athletes from dropping out. And if you're at a school that doesn't have any of those resources, why are you being held to this same metric as a school with millions of dollars towards making sure their student athletes don't fail out of school?
Yeah, I mean, that was actually kind of one of the interesting things that I didn't get to touch on a lot as much. Or some of my initial drafts had a lot more in there about that, but we kind of wanted to narrow the focus down. And so, you know, the HBCU deal is, and also most resource colleges at that end, I mean, that's fascinating because I went through the NCAA as a database of, you know, you can look at all the penalties a school has, you know, suffered throughout since the APR's been around. And so you can click on a school, you can scroll through all the, you know, 20-some teams for, you know, 12 years. And I did that with all the HBCUs, and I did that with all of the Power 5 conferences. And of the HBCUs, 22 of the 24, you know, school, I think it's 22 of the 24. 22 of the 24 had teams, multiple teams with repeating that were penalized in repeating years, whereas I'm going through the ACC and there's like, I want to say it was like NC State wrestling, and that was it, that had repeat penalized years. And so this is just this massive problem, and these schools who aren't able to, you know, fund, you know, or don't have access to the same funds are getting the brunt end of it. And yeah, I wish I would have been able to touch on that more, and I got a lot of good stuff on that. But yeah, that was the part that kind of was one of the parts that struck me. You know, it kind of struck a nerve.
All right, so Nick, thanks a lot for coming on. You know, as we've talked, it just strikes me that the moment you introduce metrics into anything that is about the quality of somebody's job performance, whether that be a player on the field or a teacher or, in this case, a coach with academic rates, it's the moment that is going to eventually be used to be talk about whether or not they're good enough at their job to justify a certain salary. And we see that happen all the time with players and whether they deserve a $200 million contract in baseball, let's say. And what's so interesting to me is that it's bled down into this area where the NCAA, because these are student athletes, has this very complicated, complex system set up, and the coaches who are athletic employees are being paid for how their players do on the academic side, but they're not technically an academic employee. And it's just, this is like a great microcosm of the strangeness of the NCAA and its incentive structure right now.
I will say if NC State did want to game this system so hard, like in those bullet points of all of the things that he could get bonuses on, you know, most of them are team. And then the last two is like, if a single player is named on academic All-American, like, wouldn't you just get some walk-on that was like, had played football one time and be like, okay, all I need is one player and all you have to do is like have a 3.5. If the NCAA wants to pretend under the guise of this team metric, fine. But, like, there's no way NC State can tell me, if you get one player on an academic All-American, here's $50,000. Like, that just cannot be incentivizing anybody to, you know.
Yeah, I actually always thought it was a little bizarre. I was going through the contract. I always thought it was a little bizarre looking at, like, the contract that were, like, get, you know, if you getting these kind of single individual awards, where the coaches got paid more. I thought that was really interesting. And kind of backwards, but I guess, you know, that's the system we live in.
All right. Nick, thanks so much for coming on, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you guys so much.
Nick Martin is a journalist in North Carolina, and his piece at Deadspin was called College Football Coaches Are Making Millions Off a Useless Metric, and we'll put a link to it on our show page at 538.com. All right, moving on to Significant Digit, when Allison McCann brings us a telling number from the world of sports. Allison, what did you find this week?
Significant Digit is 24, which is the number of touchdown receptions from Odell Beckham after his wonderful catch against the Dolphins. And that puts him at 24 touchdown receptions in 25 games, which is the second most, sadly. The only one with more is Bill Grohman, who had 27 in his first two seasons with the Houston Oilers in 1960 and 1961.
And we all remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of old men, can I be a cranky old man for a second?
Please
and just
do.
Say, I usually dislike almost all the new camera angles that happen in any sports telecast, right? That, like, they just distract you. All of a sudden, you're looking at a an angle that you were not expecting to look at, and you just want to see it in the normal angle. But that Beckham Jr. catch with the pylon camera last night, where you could see his feet and his toes kick up the sand or the turf or whatever it was that he was kicking up, was enough to calm even my most crotchety old man instincts. Has my rant really put you guys into that much of a silent spell?
Admiring the majesty of Beckham's catches.
Yeah, just
not my rant.
A moment of silence.
Your rant was not as good as Beckham's
catches. It
was not
as majestic.
No.
All right, that's fair. I'll work on the majesty of my rants. Okay.
But I just wanted to know if, what was the guy's name?
Bill Grohman.
Yeah, did someone reach him for comment on Beckham?
Beckham
didn't break the record, so I guess he is. Did he pop champagne or something because Beckham didn't eclipse his mark?
We need a pylon cam.
Is he alive?
That
was also a good question.
Inside of his coffin, whichever it is.
He appears to be alive, 79. Bill Grohman, going strong.
Well, Bill, if you're listening, let us know how you feel about Odell.
And thanks for your support of Hot Takedown.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to the credits, guys, which I will not do as impressively as Bill Grohman would. That'll do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always. It's Allison McCann. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Chad.
And Neil Payne.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast emperor is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We got production assistance from Tony Chow. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.